You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by
law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents
Monster Talk's, a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Home of such shows as the Daily Meditation Podcast, I Know What Scares You, and When Things Go Wrong. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
I got up the other day and everything in my apartment had been stolen and replaced with an exact replica. I couldn't believe it. Call my friend and I said, come here, look at this stuff. It's all an exact replica. What do you think? He said, do I know you?
You see, what we're talking about here is an organism that imitates other life forms, and it imitates them perfectly. When this thing attacked our dogs, it tried to digest them, absorb them, and in the process, shape its own cells to imitate them. This, for instance... That's not dog. It's imitation. We got to it before it had time to finish.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Hey, we're back again with Dr. Brian Sharpless to talk more about his new book, which is now available everywhere books are sold, Monsters on the Couch, the real psychological disorders behind your favorite movies. And I'm particularly excited because of all the things in the book that I found fascinating, there's one thing in particular I wanted to talk about. It's this chapter called This Is Not My Beautiful House, which is all about monsters that deal with identity. I was drawn to it because I'm fascinated by the Capgras syndrome, which shows up in a lot of neuroscience books, and Brian has lots of things to say about that. And before the credits, you heard a little clip from Stephen Wright, the comedian, and another clip from one of my favorite horror movies, John Carpenter's The Thing. I could have included many more because what we're talking about today is not movies and monsters, but the real psychological conditions that can produce some of the same uncanny moments of horror films, only in the much more consequential domain of the real world. Now, this episode has been issued with an explicit tag, and I'm telling you there's some content warning because we're going to be talking about some fun stuff, some interesting stuff, but some of these stories are about minds gone wrong, which often leads to terrible human tragedy. So if you're in a mind space where you can handle that right now, great. But if you're not, you know, hit our back catalog. We got lots of other less stressful content. Oh, hey, I think I see Brian standing right over there ready to be interviewed. Brian? Brian?
Monster Talk.
Welcome back to Monster Talk, Brian Sharpless.
Welcome back.
Been a while.
We're supposed to do that, I think. Yeah, yeah.
A couple of weeks, yeah.
I think when I was looking through the book trying to pick something for us to chat about, there was one thing.
Difficult.
It was one thing in particular, which was your chapter on This Is Not My Beautiful House, because it deals with this idea of identity, of your own identity or the identity of others, and how you mm-hmm. recognize people, and that ties yeah. into neuroscience and psychology. So
he's a Talking Heads fan.
Also yeah. true. Yeah, but you bring up The Thing and Invasion of the Body Snatchers and several other films that kind of tie into this idea. And one of the underlying conditions that sounds like this is something I've been fascinated with for a long time. So let's discuss that. But first of all, I guess we should tell people, we're excited to have you back, but how's the release been going so far?
It's been good. I've been given lots of talks. I gave talks in Bulgaria, the UK, and now I'm hitting some parts of the US on the East Coast. And yeah, very busy, very fun. Get to meet a lot of interesting and sometimes very strange people. So it's been good.
I'm sure. Brian, we want to talk about chapter 5 on misidentification. And yes. you start this chapter with a really strange story of, I'm not sure if it's Madame Martine or Martin or M, as sometimes mm-hmm. she's known. Yep. If you could share a little bit of the story with us and tell us what's really going on.
Yeah, so during World War I, this was a woman living in Paris, and she visited the police one day, and she gave quite a tale. It started out that she left for one day, and she had a recently born son, and she left him in the care of the nanny. She comes home, and the little boy is dead. So she is just beside herself with grief. She's hugging him. And then she's looking at her dead son's body very closely, and she notices things that don't make sense. She notices that his fingernails don't quite look like she remembered them. And she also thought that he looked like he was poisoned. So she comes to the conclusion that this actually isn't her son. It was a replacement. It was a dead child that was meant to look like her son. So she tells the nanny, and the nanny's like, no, this is your son. Look, he's in the same clothes. And she does not believe it. She gets very irate, and nobody believes her. So she actually goes to her funeral, the funeral of the boy, completely convinced that this is not her son. And then it gets worse. Then she believes that her daughter was replaced, but the daughter wasn't dead in this case. It was just replaced by a series of near identical duplicates in dozens of them, just one after the other. And nobody believes her, and her husband doesn't even believe her. And then she comes to the startling conclusion that her husband is also not her husband, but has been replaced. And so this kind of starts snowballing, and it involves the whole of Paris eventually. And so when she goes to the police, she tells them that all the bombings that are occurring are done with blanks. It's not actually to destroy the city. It's to lure the poor citizens of Paris underground, where they are tortured and then slowly replaced. And the replacements are set out loose on an unsuspecting public. And she fears that it might be all over France and possibly all over the whole world. Okay. So this was the first documented case of Capgras syndrome. There, it's been written about previously, but this was the case that really became famous. And Joseph Capgras was the doc who reported it, and it now bears his name. So really fascinating idea. You know, what's more terrifying than the idea that the people who you think you know aren't really the people that you know?
So it does remind me of a joke, though. There was a medical condition joke where a patient and a doctor are consulting, and the doctor says, well, I've got good news and bad news. And he's like, what's the bad news? Give it to me first. He says, well, this is an entirely new condition, so we don't know how to treat it. And he's like, oh my God, well, what's the good news? Oh, I get to name this condition after myself. What?
He's good news, yeah. It does make me think of stories of changelings.
Yes.
That, a child has been replaced, or people have been replaced, but especially children.
Absolutely, yeah. And they usually leave these bigger children in the house. Absolutely.
You know, there's a very famous, there's a very famous story. I believe it was in Ireland, where there was a man who became convinced his wife was a changeling and ultimately murdered her. And I don't think I've ever heard it mentioned in conjunction with this syndrome, but now that I'm rethinking it.
It actually has been linked with that.
Okay, well, there you go. Because it sure sounds like it. Yeah,
there was actually probably the most famous case of Capgras and violence involved this man named Walter Karloftis, who lived on Long Island. And he became convinced that his sister was not his sister, but it was a replacement. And so he subsequently murdered and dismembered his sister, put her body in two pieces of luggage and left them on, I believe, on the beach. And he was brought to trial and eventually convicted. But through the entirety of the trial, he's like, that was not my sister. And this is one of the darker sides that, you know, isn't as much fun as watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Well, but
you do see violence in 32% of cases. A fairly large review took place, and they were looking at violence. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because in most cases of Capgras, the person that's replaced is a loved one. So it's somebody that you're usually very close to. And just as a thought experiment, what would you do if you thought you were living with somebody who wasn't who you thought they were? And even worse, they might even be the ones responsible for kidnapping your real loved one. What would you do? So it's not surprising, if you think about it, that you do see violence in almost a third of cases. And you see homicide occurring in 4% of these cases.
Wow.
Yeah, scary stuff. But if you think about it, why isn't that even higher? So if those figures are accurate, how are 68% of people able to live in relative peace with somebody who they firmly believe has replaced a loved one?
I don't want to be super negative, but I mean, sometimes marriages fall into sort of a routine, and maybe it's not that closely examined anymore. It's like,
I do wonder about that. And reading the chapter, I was thinking about that. Is there, is it possible that people who are in those situations where they don't become violent, it's because they're being medicated or they're being put into convalescent homes or psychiatric institutions?
It could be if they're identified, which might not be easy, because just a lot of people don't know about this syndrome, even other medical professionals. Our best guess is that people who have the Capgras delusion, that's not the only cognitive sort of deficit they have. So they might have other problems with their reality testing and their ability to problem solve that might keep them in this very uncomfortable state where they can live and constantly accuse people of being imposters. And I got to say, this is not an uncommon disorder. It sounds really bizarre, and it makes for a great plot of movies, but you see this in 3-4% of psychiatric patients.
Wow.
And what I'm going to tell you next will blow your mind, but there are two studies that looked at Alzheimer's patients, and they found that 7-10% of Alzheimer's patients will suffer from this delusion. I've personally worked with 3 people that have suffered from Capgras. And it's even worse if you have somebody that has Lewy body dementia, 1 in 5.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I've got personal experience with this. Someone in my family.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Someone in my family who's going through this, exactly what you're talking about, has frequently expressed concern that their spouse, I'm trying to be depersonalizes, their spouse is not who they say they are, or their spouse is the spouse's brother who is dead, so that's not right, so on. It's not all the time, but just sometimes. And also there was a sort of paranoid like conviction that this person was also cheating on them, as well as not actually being their spouse, which is you know, there's a lot of conflicting delusions going on at the same time.
I guess linking them all, there's this real suspicion that the person is who that you think they are, you know, or are they or are they type of person that could cheat on me?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a lot of questions about trust and identity.
I just wanted to comment to Brian as well, that it just makes me think about better known conditions, or certainly among the general public, that have some similarities with these conditions as well, like schizophrenia or dissociative identity disorder. And I'm thinking Sybil here, and even BPD. So since we're talking about personal stories, someone in my family has recently been diagnosed with that. And you know about that, Brian.
Sure.
But I do see a little bit of crossover with just the issues with identity and almost like sometimes a Jekyll and Hyde persona, like the person's in two minds or can be.
Yeah, well, there's a lot there. Maybe I'll start with the Fregoli delusion and then we'll kind of expand.
Okay. Yeah, sound good? Sounds good.
Yeah. So there's another condition that has worked its way into, to be honest, some of my absolute favorite horror movies, namely The Thing, starring the inimitable Kurt Russell, who I just can't get enough Kurt Russell, and also It Follows. So this is called the Fregoli delusion, and this is a unique condition because it was named not after the doctor who discovered it, but after an actor. Okay, so back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was this actor named Leopoldo Fregoli, and he was famous for being a quick change artist. He could just, within seconds, change wardrobes, and he had an uncanny ability to contort his body such that he could look like a small child or an old woman or a full-grown man, like that. He was a sort of a physical genius. And so, needless to say, he was very famous. So when a couple of neurologists came upon an interesting case, they had Fregoli on their minds, no doubt. So the case goes like this, and it's similar to Capra, but you'll see it has some important differences. So in this case, it was one woman who believed that she was being tormented by two Parisian actresses. Apparently, a lot of misidentification things happen in Paris. So these two actresses would take on the physical appearance of people that she was close to, like her sister, her mother, friends, and then they would torment her. They would also make her do unseemly things. She claimed that they forced her to masturbate and do things like that. So instead of, whereas in Capgras, you have one person that you recognize as an identical looking replacement, in the Fregoli delusion, you actually see one or two separate entities that have multiple appearances and that you can tell the differences, but they look exactly like your sister, your friend, and then they are torturing you. And again, in this case, she was arrested for attacking a stranger in the street who she believed was one of the Parisian actresses. And so if you make this into a horror movie, you have The Thing. So in The Thing, these American researchers in the Arctic come upon an alien that was frozen underground for 100,000 years. It first mimics a husky. And then it morphs into multiple huskies, and then it starts replacing the people. And so it looks identically like Wilford Brimley, the Quaker Oats guy who's in the movie as well. And people are left wondering, well, who is the thing? Because, again, it's identical, and it's the same alien consciousness that keeps shifting its appearances. And so it creates you talked about paranoia. It creates a sense of paranoia that is really effective in horror movies.
Watch Clark and watch him close. Do you hear me?
So now if you take that basic plot of The Thing and you make it into a sexually transmitted disease, you have the basic plot of It Follows, which is a brilliant film that came out in 2014. And here it follows this young college student, I think she's 19, named Jay. And so she's on her third or fourth date with a guy, and they have sex for the first time. And then as she's relaxing, you know, feeling very calm and loved, he chloroforms her. And then she wakes up in a wheelchair, tied to a wheelchair, and he's saying really crazy things to her. He says to her, you know, I passed this thing to you in the car back there, and now you're going to have a bunch of people that follow you, and they're going to look different. They're going to look different every time, but it's the same thing. And it sometimes will look like people you care about just to make it hurt even worse. So the best thing you can do is just sleep with someone immediately, pass it along to them. Because otherwise, if it kills you, then it's going to come back and then kill me and then go back the chain.
It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. Whatever helps me get close to you.
So she doesn't believe him, of course. She thinks he's completely unhinged. Who would believe him? But then she starts being stalked by these entities that only she can see. And just like The Thing and just like in the Fregoli delusion, it's the same entity that appears as many different faces and bodies. So again, a really effective horror movie premise and a really, really good movie.
I've got a question about that. Do you think, Brian, that scriptwriters are inspired by these conditions, or do you think they haven't heard of them and they're just using their imaginations?
Yeah, it's a great question. I tried to contact her, the writer of It Follows, but he never got back to me. Uh-huh. My guess would good be, try. You know, people like John Carpenter and, you know, really good filmmakers, I think they have the ability to tap into things. I think John Carpenter's a brilliant guy. I don't think he was reading dusty old psychiatry journals.
He was reading the John W. Campbell, Who Goes There, and I don't know if John W. Campbell would have known, but he was obviously pretty widely read. Yep. Yeah, but it is an interesting question. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was just like, the story's really good. You should read the story, but because Carpenter goes back and, you know, he sort of makes it more like the novella than the original, it's not Howard Hawks directing, but the Howard Hawks version, they call it.
Right. But I think some filmmakers do self-consciously do it. So Wes Craven based A Nightmare on Elm Street on a few different things, primarily the deaths of the Hmong population in Orange County, California. So he was very aware of what was called sudden unexpected nocturnal death syndrome, which is a mouthful. And he used some of the newspaper reports in the film. Some of the things Nancy did were done by some of the poor Hmong who died in their sleep. So in certain cases, you can see filmmakers self-consciously working in real life disorders. And I think they should do it more. In my book, the last chapter, I give a formula for how to do it in three very fast, simple steps. But yeah, I can't imagine that John Carpenter and David Robert Mitchell were aware of this unusual syndrome. I got to tell you, I graduated with a PhD in psychology from a very good program. People who are listening now know more about Capgras now than I did when I graduated. Wow. It just wasn't covered in my... It just wasn't covered in my program because we have the entire DSM and it's not in the DSM.
It's not.
It's a thick book, but
Not a codable diagnosis. You can code it as something else, like a delusional disorder not otherwise specified. But yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
But it's also like putting other on a form. Everybody's just gonna use other. That's other. What?
Yep.
American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more, right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
It's time for today's Lucky Land Horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say. Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, what is there any working model for why Fregoli or Capgras happen?
So for Capgras, the earliest theories were formulated by some of Freud's followers. So they based it on the idea of splitting, which is a concept that you see in personality disorders. Karen mentioned that. So people with borderline personality disorder, they engage in a lot of splitting in one way where they can't see a person as gray. They vacillate between seeing them sort of as all good or all bad. It's very hard to see the nuanced gray in between.
They're very familiar with this, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it can be very confusing, not only for the person who's on the receiving end of the splitting, but for the person who's actually doing the splitting. And then there's another a sort of related concept where this is sort of how it would go. So in every relationship that you have, you know, and of course, don't think about your own lives here.
No.
But,
right.
But everybody that you love, everybody you have a really deep relationship with, you also hate. There are also things about them. Of course, you love them. There are things you really value about them. But there are things that drive you up the wall that you can't stand. And so most of us can tolerate that and we can accept the hateful things just as well as the loving things, and we can keep an integrated image. Some people, we think, can't quite do this. So what they do is they can't tolerate the idea that they hate the people they love. So those feelings get split off from the loving feelings. And so what the earliest theories of Capgras would say would be the loving feelings now are with that partner who is gone. So the one they're pining for that has been replaced, that is the repository of the loving feelings. And all those nasty, hateful things get put on the replacement. So it's really a psychic compromise so that you can maintain some positive thoughts about your loved one while also accepting the negative thoughts. So it's an interesting theory. There's not a lot of data on it, but it does sort of tap into one of the peculiarities of Capgras, which is the people that are being replaced aren't the milkman or, you know, your favorite server. They're usually a first degree relative. It's a parent or a spouse in most of the cases. So these are people who you have complicated and very rich feelings and connections with. So there are more modern theories apply what's called a two-hit theory to Capgras. And so the first hit is you have an unusual perception or a thought. So, you know, we've all had small experiences of depersonalization, for instance. So if you're one day, you know, washing your hands in the bathroom and you look at yourself in the mirror, you recognize that yourself, but something feels off. You might almost feel unreal for a second. Have you ever had one of those strange feelings?
Only in the morning.
Oh, yeah. What?
Only in the morning. Yeah. They're really not uncommon, especially when people are having panic attacks. They can really feel that they or the environment are unreal. So that's a normal experience, and most of us dismiss it pretty easily. You know, just like I occasionally dismiss the thought that I might be unconventionally handsome. It quickly goes out the window. And so
again, for me, only in the morning, it just
goes. So that's the first hit. You get this unusual perception or thought. But you need the second hit to make the thought not go away and in fact become possible and even worst, plausible or even fully certain. And so that's where other conditions come into play. So you mentioned the psychotic disorders. So people that have psychotic disorders can also have Capgras syndromes. You can see this in very severe forms of depression that have psychotic features, but you can see it in seizure disorders, like I said, dementias. There are cases of people that have advanced HIV and AIDS developing Capgras syndromes because it affects their cognitive functioning so much. And in terms of brain stuff, people that have lesions in particular parts of the right hemisphere, which is associated with identity and sometimes perceiving oneself and other people. So people that have lesions in that area can have it as well. And there was a case of somebody with intellectual disability who developed Capgras syndrome. So there are a number of second hits that might make it hard to get rid of that first unusual thought. And again, make it feel certain, because this is a delusion. By definition, a delusion is a fixed thought that is not responsive to counter evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, it's very similar to a conspiracy theory, which again ties in nicely into the movies. Because a lot of people that will have the very rigid fixed conspiracy theories, it can reach the level of delusion.
Well, you talk about this a bit in the chapter, but when and I didn't answer it because it's not exactly the same thing which you were asking about. But one of my fears, an irrational fear that has been with me since I was a child, is the fear that I would go in front of a mirror and that my reflection would do something different than me. Sometimes as little as wink or smile at me sinister, you know, just and it's just like that's all it takes to set me up. And I can't look in the mirror as I brush my teeth. And even now I'm a rational human being and I know better. But late at night, you know, it's like, I'm just going to look at the sink, you know.
Mirrors are worked up into so much mythology if you think about it. I mean, the mirror vampire connection seems to be a Hollywood creation, but I mean, if you look at people, people of the Jewish faith, what they cover up mirrors after people die. It's a Bulgarian tradition as well. And I mean, John Carpenter, speaking of the man, the myth, if you watch Prince of Darkness, mirrors played very heavily in that, and mirrors were a portal to hell. So, yeah. And then there's a different variation of the things we've been talking about called mirrored self misidentification. And this is very similar to what your fear was if you actually didn't just fear it but experienced it.
Yes.
So if you were looking at the mirror, you would not recognize your reflection. You would say, that looks like Blake, but it's an autonomous entity that looks like Blake. And it might not like you.
That's always the fear, that it's not just that it's not me. It's that it's not me and it's got a bad intent.
Exactly. It might not just be winking at you. It might be flipping you off. Yeah.
It hates and me reflexively.
And what's really strange with people that have this, you can show them a photograph of themselves and they will clearly recognize, hey, that's Blake. But when they're in front of a mirror, and a mirror specifically, that's when they have this misidentification. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, well, Brian, this is a perfect lead-in to talk about doppelgangers. And we love doppelgangers. We haven't done a show on them yet. We really need to. But you mentioned the story of Catherine the Great in your book. Could you tell us that tale?
I will. I will jump back a bit and say that just throughout history, the mythology of doppelgangers is amazing, so I hope you do a show on that. But it was usually perceived as a harbinger of doom.
Yes.
So if you were to see your doppelganger, which is the posh German term for double walker, if you actually saw it, something really bad was going to happen. And there are cases of that. So Percy Blythe Shelley, who is Mary Shelley's husband, the author of Frankenstein, he supposedly saw his doppelganger shortly before he drowned. Goethe also saw his doppelganger, but he lived quite a long life. He was strangely comforted when he saw his doppelganger. But the best one, as you're alluding to, is the story of Catherine the Great. So this is probably apocryphal, to be honest. I couldn't find a lot of documentation, especially about what happened when she got assertive. And I'll tell that tale in a minute. But so the way it starts, she reclines to her bedroom. And so she's laying on her fancy bed. And one of the servants comes in and is very puzzled and says to her, you know, you're here, but I just saw you in the throne room. And she's like, what are you talking about? I've been here. So she gets up and gets her guards and she goes to walks her way to the throne room, and sitting there on this ornate golden red chair, she sees herself just staring. And so she calls out to it and it makes no sound, doesn't respond, which she thinks is pretty strange, I'm guessing. And being a woman that never lacked assertion, she then ordered her guards to fire upon it. And
as
here's
you do.
Where, yeah, right. Totally sensible. But I couldn't figure out what happened when she fired upon it. So I found a few different versions of the story and they all ended with that. So I have no idea if they struck it or what, but she, you know, lived at least a few years after that, but yeah, probably an apocryphal tale.
Yeah. Amazing though.
Yes. Oh yeah. It's one of those things you hope is true.
Like, absolutely.
Skepticism kind of can rob the fun out of life.
Well,
sometimes.
You know, you could be skeptical, but if you – well, I actually have run into a doppelganger of myself, which was not a supernatural thing so far as I know. But it was so stunning because it wasn't like someone looked kind of like me, which I experience frequently. Like when I go to Dragon Con, there's 30 or 40 of me walking around. But I mean, to someone who looks so much like me that both me and my wife – were startled by it, and we were across a busy restaurant, and so I started I think I even had a shirt very similar to what I was wearing, and I went after him trying to catch him, and he was with his family, and just people, it was like a movie, people kept stepping in front of me and like rolling trays out or coming, and it was like I couldn't get just I finally got a really terrible photo of him from, you know, from way off, and this was probably 2013, 2012. So the phones weren't that great anyway. It was really disappointing. I really just wanted to meet him. And because, I mean, he was probably about 6 inches taller than me. But other than that, he looked exactly like me and it was freaky. So,
You will hear kind of experiences similar to this if you read twin studies. So in Minnesota and in Norway, they have these huge databases where they've brought in identical and fraternal twins for decades identical twins that were reared apart, when they do run upon each other, they do describe it as being sort of uncanny and this very strange experience, sort of similar to what you were saying, where you were just struck by it and you felt compelled to, you know, to get closer in spite of you're in a crowded restaurant, you're getting all these weird things happening. They will have an experience sort of similar to what you said, and it would be so bizarre. You know,
maybe,
I'm an only child.
Maybe. So. There's a theory.
A weird story like this was on NPR recently, where it was a pair of identical twins and another pair had one baby swapped. So the parents were raising, each of them was raising the other and their own child. They met, the doubles met when like one went into a bakery and someone began to joke with them about why weren't they somewhere else. You know, they met and realized, then the brothers met. It's a really crazy story. But I remember them talking about this. Well, you're joking. This can't be real. How could this be? You know, like it's just super mysterious.
How could I see myself outside?
It's
an out-of-body experience.
Is that really what my butt looks like? These are great questions.
Very strange. Well, we should start to wrap things up. But I want to ask you, Brian, if there's any good news to this. Can these conditions be treated and how?
Yes. The good news is sort of the bad news, because it's so common that there have been, fortunately, lots of opportunities to, you know, treat folks with this condition. So the main approach is really to treat what you think is driving the delusion. So if they also have schizophrenia, you would put them on an antipsychotic like Risperdal. If they're, you know, suffering from depression, throw them on citalopram, which is a very effective drug, which in small doses is very useful for the folks that have the dementia versions. People with dementia are exquisitely sensitive to medication side effects, so you have to be really careful with them. But citalopram seems to be well tolerated in people with Capgra, from what the research studies say. A last course of treatment is pretty effective, electroconvulsive therapy. So, which I think we might have talked about in the last time I was here, but it looks really scary, especially on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But it's far more sophisticated than it used to be, and for people that have treatment refractory depression or psychotic depression, other things aren't working. This can be a godsend.
My grandmother lived to be 100 and probably would not have had she not had that. So yeah,
some people used it pretty haphazardly, kind of like how they were using transorbital lobotomies.
I was thinking exactly of that. Yes. It's like, this has an effect. It has an effect. It does.
It does, and oftentimes really a scary bad one. But the problem with every field, and medicine is no different, is that once something new is created, they start applying it to everything, and sometimes in cases that it's not really appropriate for. Yep.
Yeah.
But there are treatment options. Sadly, for my specific field, traditional psychotherapy doesn't seem to be terribly effective, because as with every delusion, you can't really argue somebody out of a delusion. You can really set the stage for them to sort of argue themselves out of it. But there is a type of psychotherapy called supportive psychotherapy, which has different goals than traditional types of approaches, and it might actually make it potentially more effective, the other treatments more effective and more easy to kick
in.
And for the people that are living with it, I think therapy for them could be useful as well, because could you imagine how hard it would be to live with somebody who you have to take care of for their basic needs, and yet they think you are a phony and you're keeping their real loved one away from them. It'd be horrifying.
So we've had you here discussing your book. We're super excited about it. There'll be links in the show notes. So our wrap-up question for you, because you're a repeat guest, you already told us your favorite monster. What are you doing for Halloween? Anything special? You got any favorite movies you're going to watch? What are you doing for Halloween?
I am giving a talk on the book in D.C. more work.
A working holiday.
A working holiday. But I actually have a few relatives coming. And my mother is actually coming. She's never seen me give a public lecture before, so
don't forget that. We'll see the content warning before you start. What?
Yeah, right. We'll see her reaction when I start getting into the ins and outs of cannibals.
It's like, that can't be my son.
That's right. Show off Capra. Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, good luck with that.
With a foul mouth to begin.
This explains everything. Thank you again. Thank you again for joining us to talk about this fascinating stuff.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
We'll have to have you back on again. There's always something to talk about with you.
All right.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with friend of the show, psychologist and author Brian Sharpless, discussing yet another fascinating chapter from his book, Monsters on the Couch. A link to his book is in the show notes, so check it out. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Stay tuned, because next week we'll be getting into some classic Monster Talk, combining monsters, the media, biology, hoaxes, exaggerations, and so much more. Oh, and a lot of pig jokes, because we're finally going to tackle Hogzilla. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks so much for making our little show a part of your big lives.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.